Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I hope you're doing well today. We have a great episode. Actually, this is going to be a two-part episode, a little bit experimental. We're going back into tabletop gaming, and we are going behind the scenes of a Kickstarter project. Why experimental? Because I've had several conversations with a game designer called Ed Jowett. I have met Ed at Dragon Meet in London, and Ed has a games company, an independent games company called Shades of Vengeance, and Shades of Vengeance produces a science fiction-based setting game called Era the Consortium, and he is now in the final stages of a Kickstarter project for an expansion book detailing a little bit more of that science fiction universe called The Secret War. And I've started calling the conversation we're having the Secret Kickstarter Conversations, because we've decided rather than having one long interview, to have a few different conversations over the course of time to update little by little on all the different projects in terms of game design and role-playing game he has going on. And also for everybody interested in what happens in the behind the scenes of a Kickstarter project of a, you know, normal, well, or at least smallish size. It's not like the big, gigantic millions of dollars project. This is indie gaming and, how do you run a successful project? What it takes? How do you create a game? Ed has helped other people create their own games and design their own games as well as design his own. So I think this is going to be a really, really interesting conversation for people interested in tabletop gaming, role-playing games, what it takes to run a Kickstarter project, what really happens behind the scenes of a Kickstarter project, or any crowdfunding project. Of course, Kickstarter is one of the main platforms out there, but there are many other platforms. So really, when I mean kickstarting, just, you know, you can switch it around for crowdfunding altogether. For a little bit of promotion, of course, I have now moved to London, so I'm not in London full-time, but, you know, I'm usually traveling for work as well, where different projects and different clients going on, but I'm always open to new projects, so if ever you're looking for any advice, support on your brand and marketing strategy, whatever business you have going on, I'm always happy to help. I had an interview with another game designer you might have listened to, another British game designer as well, James Wallace, whose consulting services starts as at Buy Me Lunch, and I'm seriously considering to start the same deal, which is, you know, if my consulting services buy it, start at buying me lunch. Don't hesitate getting in touch. You can find all my details on my website. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out, icecreamforeveryone.net. On there, you can, of course, find the podcast. You can find my weekly newsletter. If you want to read more about me, my stories, my inspirations, then that's mostly happening in written form on a weekly basis in the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter, which tends to be a kind of relatively long-formish article on previous experiences of mine, whatever inspires me, a few side references, and you can check out the archive, read a couple of them, see if you enjoy them. It's meant to be like a personalized long email to you, something enjoyable to read on a Sunday. And of course, if you enjoy listening to this episode, or if you enjoy listening to any other episodes of the podcast, please just send it over to a friend. If you listen on iTunes, give it a rating or a review. It really helps us and really helps other people discover the show. I can't repeat it often enough. And that's about it. I'll let Ed speak. So as I said, this is the first part of a two-part episode. You'll get the second part next week. Hey, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for taking the time to join me for this. Really appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I usually start with a warm-up question, and I was just browsing around and looking at your website and the Kickstarter you just launched, which we'll be talking about a little bit more. The games company run is called Shades of Vengeance, but there's another name called Imagine RPG, which I had from the Dragon Meet convention where we met last in December last year.
Right.
Is it two names? Is it actually one? Or did you have one and change? Or?
No. Okay, so what it is Shades of Vengeance is a name that, for me, it's a reference back to my days as a World of Warcraft player, actually.
Okay.
And when I quit World of Warcraft, the person who first worked with me on this stuff was from my guild, which was called Vengeance in World of Warcraft. So, you know, Shades of Vengeance is what remains of the Guild Vengeance. And that's how the company got its name originally. Now, when presenting to people who, are looking to talk about a game company, that's brilliant. You know, I mean, it's a sort of a whimsical name. You know, there are names out there like White Wolf and so on, which have very, you know, Wizards of the Coast, sort of very whimsical names, and it fits in very nicely there.
Yeah.
But it doesn't fit in so well as a brand name for Don't Worry, We'll Help You. Right? So I came up with Imagine RPG. I had a little help with it, actually. One of my regular artists suggested it. You know, we were looking for something like My RPG, Imagine RPG. You know, we came up with this idea, and I checked the URL and it was free. And for bringing in people to help them create their game, I think that Imagine RPG is a much better name for that section of the company, if that makes sense.
Cool. Got it. No, that's very interesting, and that's definitely something that I'll be interested in talking about from looking at your website, the fact that you help other creators and other game creators to launch their games. So we were just talking before we launched the record button about the fact that you just have a Kickstarter project, a crowdfunding project, launched today, correct?
That's right. Yeah, it was just today. It's doing very well. I'm very happy. We've already nearly reached the funded mark.
Congratulations.
We're very pleased. I mean, this is something about Kickstarters. You sort of have a choice. You can go into the Kickstarter and make the decision that you're going to not make this thing unless you get the money you need to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who has any idea about how much artwork costs will know that £455 or £500 is not going to cover even close to what it costs to make even the expansion. You know, it's not even close to the number that's required, especially when you take out printing costs and shipping costs.
Yeah, exactly.
And all of the rest of the stuff like that. So what I do when I run a Kickstarter is I create the product first.
Okay.
Or at the very least get very, very close. Totally honestly, The Secret War is not 100% finished. It's about 98% finished. You know, so I get it to that stage so that I have something to show. I mean, if you scroll down in the Kickstarter, you'll see very quickly there's actually a layout from the expansion book. So I take the risk when running a Kickstarter in this way that I don't recoup the amount of money that I've spent on it. It is a risk to take. The alternative risk, of course, is to set your goal at the level that it actually costs. And I think that there is a problem in the community of people who actually buy role-playing games that they don't realize how much time, effort, and cost it really does take to develop them.
Yeah.
You know, they look at a game and they go, oh, well, 30 quid for 300 pages. Yeah, okay, that's probably fair. And they'll buy it. But they don't really think about, you know, how many, frankly, tens of thousands of pounds might have gone into that in order to actually make it what they're seeing. And particularly for an indie publisher, it can be very, very difficult because, you know, you don't, I'm not Wizards of the Coast. I'm not Hasbro. I don't print millions and millions of copies of my book. You know, I've sold about 200 copies of Era of the Consortium, including the digital versions I've sold. So, you know, I mean, by comparison, that's, you know, it's a minuscule amount of money.
Yeah.
And in order to not price myself out of the market, I have to take, because again, very small print runs, I have to take a very low amount of profit from each book. Era of the Consortium hasn't come close to paying back, the development costs.
Interesting. All right. So I definitely want to push into that a little bit more, but let's track back a little bit. So two things. One, but we've decided with Ed to have a couple of different conversations over the course of the Kickstarter project, and then the episode will be published at the end of it. So hopefully we'll have interesting updates and develop the conversation as the Kickstarter project develops. But, you know, we should start at the beginning. And Ed, can you introduce yourself?
Absolutely. Well, hello, everybody. My name is Ed. I am based in London, as you might be able to tell from the accent. I started playing role-playing games. Actually, I started with computer-based role-playing games, a particular game called Mega Traveller. Mega Traveller 1, in fact, it was called, which I had on the CBM Amiga at the ripe old age of about 4. I used to sit there for hours rolling characters. Not that I really knew what that meant at the time. I was just hitting the enter button on no, I wouldn't like to develop this character. And of course, that sort of got me the, you know, I that meant that I started off my role-playing career with the game that says, by the way, your character died during character creation. Which I'm sure
that was an option.
I'm sure some people have come across that at some point.
I didn't even know about that game. I don't remember. Was it like a sci-fi kind of thing, or
it was Traveller?
So it was based on the role-playing game Traveller, right?
Based on the role-playing game Traveller, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So you know, I started with that, and as I grew up, as I grew older, I began to get more involved in tabletop role-playing games. Mm-hmm. Particularly at university, I ended up GMing very, very quickly. I played about 4 sessions, and then they were so short of GMs that I stood up and said, okay, I'll do it. And that was when I GM'd my first game, which was Paranoia.
Okay.
Very easy to GM Paranoia. Yes, very, very
it's
easy.
It's a lot of fun. Actually, interesting. The last episode I published was with conversation with James Wallace, who's rewriting Paranoia at the moment.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thing about Paranoia, you see, is it's against the rules for the players to know the rules. Yes. So as a complete newbie GM, it was really not a difficult game to GM because no one could call me out on making mistakes.
That's good.
very confidence building.
What were you studying at the time?
I studied computer science.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And I, you know, when I finished, well, actually, there's one more story to tell about while I was at university, because that's really where Era of the Consortium started. Every year, I went to Durham University up north in England, for anyone who doesn't know. Durham University, every year, the Gaming Society runs a 24-hour role-playing game. 6 GMs and only 5 groups.
Okay.
Of you know, like 5 or 6 people, and we take them through a 24-hour interlaced campaign. So all of these 5 groups have interlaced actions that all interact with each other, and the GMs take 5 minutes between sessions to sort of make sure that all of the outcomes affect the next groups.
And everybody plays 24 hours all together?
Everyone plays 24 hours. The only people who get any rest, each GM manages to get 1 session off.
Wow.
In the 24 hours. They get some rest. But the players don't. Again, it gets easier to GM as time goes on.
Yes.
So every year, the Gaming Society nominates several people who then go away, sit in a room for, you know, various meetings during the year and come up with a unique game setting.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, you know, the previous year, they'd done a low fantasy thing. So they were looking at sci-fi. Sci-fi happens to be my particular area of expertise, to be totally honest.
Okay.
What
are you, do you have favorite authors or influences in the sci-fi area?
Oh, yeah. I would say the heavy ones are things like Dune.
Yeah.
I'm actually a massive fan of Babylon 5 for continuity and the care which the writer whose name I can't pronounce, so I'm not even going to try, go look it up.
I agree. I can't remember his name either, but I really like the TV show.
I remember his name very well, I just can't pronounce it. anyway, he took a lot of care in terms of the continuity, and I've never seen that in any other TV series on that level. So, you know, they basically said, okay, we're doing a sci-fi game, and someone suggested that we do Firefly. That wasn't taken 100% well by everyone because previously, you know, every year it had been something unique. So we took the Firefly concept of, you know, various aspects of the concept, you know, having this in the center, there's civilization on the outskirts, not so much,
mm-hmm.
and various other elements like that. And we brought it sort of away from the Firefly universe to make it our own.
Yeah.
And that's really where Era of the Consortium started. We didn't call it the Consortium, but we did have a group of companies which were planning an evil plot. We started talking about alien races, and at that point I actually brought up two alien races, the Eunutians and the Zimians, mm-hmm. which were almost exactly identical to what now appears in the book, because I'd invented them many, many years ago. And the Eunutians and the Zimians became playable characters in this 24-hour game. So, you know, when the 24-hour game ran, it was very, you know, it was very much, an offshoot of the World of Darkness rule set. We decided we liked that as a group better. You know, we basically used the World of Darkness rule set. Hmm. And because we like the dice pools and so on, you know, I've carried a lot of these opinions forward to creating Era of the Consortium as it happens. But yeah, that's really where Era of the Consortium sort of started, the very kernel, the very core of it.
So the main game that you created is, because for the people who don't know, a lot of people who play role-playing games from, well, teenage years and students, so a lot of people do create their own homegrown, you know, universe or offshoots from existing games. So the game that you created was this case. So it's been like brewing and you've been playing with people for a long time then?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, ever since, and that was about 10 years ago now. Cool. That I did that game. And then, you know, when I left university, I actually had a very dry spot where I didn't play any role playing games.
Yeah.
But I ran
like
into
beginning of career and work and like that, or?
Yeah, pretty much. Cool. But I ran into a few people at work who were interested in doing it, and sort of I started up a new group. And when I started this new group, you know, I basically had two choices. I could do Paranoia, but as I think most people who've played it know, it's not great for really long term.
No.
Yeah, eventually, it starts grating.
Yeah.
Era of the Consortium was the logical choice to reach once they'd reached the maturity of players. They were all first-timers at the time. And I ran a campaign that bore a similarity in story to the one that we'd developed at Durham University.
Yeah.
Why reinvent the wheel? It was a really good campaign, you know? So we just played, as I said, there were five groups that all did sort of interlocking stuff. For about, what was it? It was 4 6-hour sessions, I want to say, offhand.
And did you first tell them about role-playing games and they didn't know? I'm interested in that kind of initiation.
Yes.
Part of that. Did they play video games or other things like that? Or?
Yeah, most of them had played a game like Mass Effect before, you know, where it's a role-playing game in inverted commas.
Yeah.
None of them had ever actually sat around and done a tabletop role-playing game before.
Cool. And did they play any board games or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just sort of the normal kind of board games that people play.
Okay.
Nothing really that they could really equate to the role-playing games, which is, you know, as I said, which is why I started out with the Paranoia thing.
Yeah.
I felt that maybe they'd be able to better understand the role-playing in a situation where dying didn't matter. Yeah.
What do you usually recommend for people if they hear about role-playing games, tabletop, and they might be interested in trying? Do you have a usual go-to either game or recommendation to find other players?
Yeah, but this is going to sound terrible. My actual recommendation nowadays is Era of the Consortium.
Oh, sure. But the title, yes, that's fine.
Like I said, it sounds terrible because I'm, you know, promoting my own game.
Yes, of course. So they participate in the Kickstarter, buy Era of the Consortium, and then how do they find other? They just get their friends around them to play it.
Well, alternatively, and this actually happens to me a lot, uh-huh. We go to a lot of conventions during the year.
Yeah.
A lot of them are not role-playing specific conventions. We go to MCM Comic-Con twice a year.
Right.
In London. And, you know, we run into a lot of people who've never played role-playing games before. We sit them down and they absolutely love it.
Yeah.
I have one of my current team who actually joined us after his first ever role-playing game experience was Era of the Consortium.
Yeah.
And he's actually joined our team and he works with us at conventions now.
Got it. Cool. So, by the way, so we didn't finish on, so what's the job you're in right now?
I'm a project manager in software development.
Okay. Got it. Great. So software development, project management, software development by day and game creator and writer by night.
Indeed. Indeed.
All right, great. Excellent.
Don't get me wrong. I would love to be a full-time game creator, but I'm not at that level of fame yet.
Yeah. So you started playing with your colleagues. Sorry, we're just going a little bit roundabout.
Yes.
And started obviously playing at Era of the Consortium.
So yeah, we started playing Era of the Consortium, and that's where Stiletto Unit came from. Stiletto Unit is the unit that everyone will play. It's the one that I provide in the free playtest pack on the Kickstarter. And it's the one that everyone who comes to our conventions and plays Era of the Consortium will play as. They'll all know, you know, at least one name from that unit. Mm-hmm. Because it was their character. And each of those characters for me holds a special significance because, you know, one was my brother, one was my best friend, one was, you know, a really good friend I made at work, and so on. And we were able to give these characters such character flaws, you know, that the guys who played Stiletto Unit originally, they, you know, Alex Geiter is a drunkard, right? He's a drunken sniper. Mm-hmm. That's terrifying for anyone who's on his side. You know, the leader of the unit is a coward. You know, and the guys sat around the table just came up with this stuff on the fly. And it really, really worked really, really well, which is why I eventually chose it to be sort of the session that we show to people. This is what Era of the Consortium is like. There's also the fact that, and I can't talk too much about what the session involves because there are potential spoilers for it.
Right.
But there's also the fact that it's a very memorable session. You are sent in to a giant spaceship to stop a weapon of mass destruction that will kill 14 billion humans and aliens. You're sent to stop it from firing, no matter what. And then the group takes over. And I've had all kinds of scenarios where they succeeded, where they failed miserably, where they've made things even worse than 14 billion. I think the record was 24 billion. They managed to kill not only the people that the weapon was targeting, but a whole bunch of other people as well.
That sounds like a lot of people. It's a crazy genocide.
Yeah, crazy genocide. No, I wasn't really going anywhere.
Okay.
Please.
No, I was just going to say, so can you give us a little bit of an overview of the world? So we know that Era of the Consortium is a sci-fi game.
That's right.
Science fiction. Can you give us a little bit of a quick overview?
Sure. Yeah. Okay, so Era of the Consortium is based at least 1,000 years in the future from now. It's very uncertain exactly when it is because there are no records surviving from Earth. Era of the Consortium has 500 years of playable history. You can play at any point from being the first colonists that land on a massive colony ship carrying millions of people, mostly in cryostasis, I should say. You know, they land and they wake up with no memory. Mm. So they form a society. And that society grows. They eventually encounter wormholes, which lead them to other solar systems, aliens. There's a very benign first contact with the first alien species they meet. And then there is a horrifically, what's the best word? Unfortunate.
Okay.
First contact with the second race that they meet. They end up in a 20-year-long war, which only ends when humanity wipes out effectively, they're old people and children. Mm. It's not trying to say that humanity is brilliant. In the way that Star Trek has humanity evolved,
yeah.
This does not go there.
Okay.
It actually, if anything, goes in the other direction. It asks the question, what happens when humanity is really completely consequenceless? So the changing situation allows GMs to choose any kind of scenario that they want to play. They can play, you know, a political thriller or, you know, an intense legal battle. Personally, I think those two sound incredibly boring, but I'm sure there are people out there, and in fact, I know there are people out there who do enjoy that kind of session. You know, you can play high-tech dungeon crawls in sort of a almost a Shadowrun-esque kind of feel.
Okay.
You know, raiding a mega company.
Mm.
You can play all-out combat if you want to. You can play investigation kind of scenarios where you're, you know, investigating a colony that's gone quiet.
Yeah.
that there are all kinds of different things that you can do. And the GM can really do anything with this framework, which is what I designed Era of the Consortium to be.
Yeah. So you launched the game successfully last year, and now you've got a new Kickstarter project that's launched today, as we mentioned, and that's for an expansion pack to describe a new... you can tell us what it is rather than me trying to do that.
Yeah. The expansion is about a new kind of operative.
Okay.
That's actually been acting all the way through the history of the consortium. The consortium side is called Shades, and they work exclusively for the most powerful company in the consortium, Hayden Bank.
Okay.
Now, Shades have been working throughout the history of the consortium to keep Hayden Bank on top of everybody. That might be blackmail, it might be data theft, it might be assassination, if need be.
Mm.
There are not very many of them, but they're all 100% dedicated to making sure Hayden Bank stays on top.
Yeah.
And in order to help them do this, they're given amazing technology, like stuff that most of the rest of the consortium could only dream of. Now, when the Resistance, who are the group that opposed the consortium in this superweapon, and then later, you know, if a government can make this superweapon and still lie about it after it was destroyed, spoilers, in the canon, Stiletto Unit is successful in destroying the weapon. I'm sure that doesn't come as too much of a shock.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if a government can do this, then, you know, how can we trust them to govern us? So the Resistance continues even beyond the destruction of this weapon. And the Resistance finds out about these Shades, which work for Hayden Bank, these operatives. And they create their own core of phantoms, which are given the best technology that the Resistance has access to. And then as Shades are defeated, phantoms are primarily intended to stop Shades from doing what they're doing.
Okay.
And as Shades are defeated, they will salvage technology from the Shades in order to improve the Phantoms. So, you know, after a year or two of Phantoms actually targeting Shades, obviously the Shades begin to get wise to it. You know, they know what's going on now, but several of them have fallen, and obviously their technology has been taken. A lot of it's been reverse engineered and figured out, and then it's implanted into the Phantoms, who will then be hunting them. So it gives you, I mean, you can add this into a session. For example, a Shade might be going with a consortium squad in order to, destroy a Resistance cell.
Yep.
But the Shade might be under orders to download all of the information before they blow up whatever area it's in.
Yep.
You know, and the rest of the team might not know about this, for example.
Brilliant. Well, I think let's stop it here, and we can organize another call for next week. What do you think?
Absolutely, yeah.
How are things a week later?
Well, things a week later are little better. So I mean, today, you know, we're going to have a bit more of a conversation about Kickstarter.
Yeah.
With Seth.
So stats-wise, a week later, I have the page open. Yeah, I don't know if you have the page open as well.
Yep.
So do you want to just like give us where we're at the numbers based like after? So I mean, literally, it's day 7 of the Kickstarter, right?
It is day 7 of the Kickstarter. We're now at 32 backers.
Okay.
We have a pledged of £944,
mm-hmm.
Which is nearly double our stated goal.
Yep.
And we got 26 days to go.
Got it. And did you have a plan of where you'd like to be every day of the Kickstarter or every week of the Kickstarter?
No, I don't. Now, actually, that's an interesting question, because the reason why is actually rather interesting.
Okay.
What always happens with every Kickstarter, and I'm sure that you will have heard this before, I'm sure your listeners will as well, the first few days, the first week or so, mm-hmm. is big.
Right.
You know, you get loads of backers, you get people coming in who are interested. The reason why? It's featured on the Kickstarter page under new.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of, it's near the top of the list.
Hmm.
Now, as time goes on, it's no longer part of new. It just becomes part of games.
Yeah.
And until you reach the last 48 hours or even the last 24 hours, it doesn't even approach near the top of the list of games. So people will have to scroll a very long way down to actually find it through Kickstarter. And Kickstarter is the widest audience, in my opinion, of people who are looking for things, you know, who are looking for things to back on Kickstarter, if that makes sense.
Oh, you mean the website itself is people browsing the website rather than coming from Facebook or Twitter or anywhere else?
That's it exactly. I've always had more success with people coming from Kickstarter or directly referred by like my website or me at conventions or whatever.
So does the back end of Kickstarter tell you where the backers come from? Is there like kind of visit statistics a little bit?
It does. Yeah, it does. It tells you. There's kind of a, they call it a backer dashboard. And when you go in there, you get like, first you get a graph, very similar to what you see on KickTrack, showing, you know, where your pledges have been at each day.
So for the people who don't know, by the way, KickTrack is a website that tracks a lot of the, well, success and funding goals of different projects in different categories.
That's right. Yeah. And then you have the most important bit for me, which is the list of where everyone came from.
Yeah.
So, for example, you always have some which are direct traffic. Those are the ones who've got the link, you know, kickstarter.com/project/shadesofvengeance/era-the-consortium-the-secret-war and gone straight there. You know, So there's no referrer information in that. Then, you know, you get info even from different categories on Kickstarter. So I've got 7 backers from tabletop games Discover, for example, and 3 from Advanced Discovery, and then 2 from Newest.
Yeah. So included those new projects that you talked about.
Yeah. So that would be a list of only the newest, whereas Tabletop Games Discover also would have come in the early days because I would have been near the top of the list of tabletop games because it was a brand new project.
Yeah, absolutely. So what kind of preparation do you do in advance for before the launch to make sure that you have as many people as possible? Like, is there any, what do you go through?
Well, the ideal thing to do is to go on a site like prefundia.com.
Okay, I did not know that site. That's interesting.
That's a site which specializes in exactly this sort of thing. You put up your project on Prefundia before you go on to Kickstarter, and they, you know, people, when it goes on to Kickstarter, you just hit a button, and everyone who said they're interested gets an email saying, by the way, the Kickstarter's active now. Also, obviously, you know, Facebook and Twitter talking about it ahead of time, generating some interest. There's a lot of information on my website about Era of the Consortium in general and a few bits and pieces about the Secret War in particular. And I run weekly news posts on Era of the Consortium specifically.
Yeah.
I sort of have, the way I set it up, I have one day a week for each game.
Okay.
So, you know, I have a writer who works with me on that. She also works on Era of the Consortium and, she wrote Era Liars with me as well. She every week we have a meeting and we talk about what's going on right now and what we're going to put in the news post. And she goes away, writes those up and sends them back to me.
And did you choose this time of year as a particular time of year to launch the Kickstarter, or just the product happened to be mostly ready and you just went ahead with it, or?
Well, you do have to think about the time of year a little bit. It was actually ready before Christmas. It could have gone before Christmas, but that would have been insane for obvious reasons. No one has disposable income at that time of year. I won't claim it's the most ideal possible time of year. I found that's actually October.
Okay.
The reason is all of the university students have just gone to university. They've got their student loans and they've realized how much money they have for the first time.
Yeah.
and you know, I mean, I remember I went a little nuts when I was that age. You know, I bought loads of stuff, and you know, that's a time of year that a lot of people have some disposable income. They're looking for something a bit of fun. They want it to arrive before Christmas. You know, this kind of time of year is really, really good for role playing games. But this was ready. I've got other projects in the pipeline. I want to do several releases this year of various games.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't want to sit on it until October
Of course. And so last time you mentioned a little bit that about the funding goal, the original funding goal for this project is £500. And as you said, it is really low and doesn't cover exactly the cost. And that's part of your strategy is to go low and then to go above the pledge fund, as I understand it. Can you tell us a little bit more about Anything else that pertains to your strategy for the funding?
Yes, you're right. I did talk about that last time a little bit, and I make the choice to bring in, you know, a low amount of money. Now, that does bring some negative opinions, because a lot of people look at it and go, oh, well, you know, is this person going to deliver for this amount of money? Mm. So what I try to do to counter that is I show that, you know, the book is finished or very nearly finished. The reason I set the print, the numbers at what I have is it's really for the minimum reasonable size print run. Mm. So I know that bringing in £500, I can do a print run, a reasonably large print run of The Secret War. Now, I would love to, you know, print so many copies that I just can't even cover it. But what I do is I make sure, and if you scroll down actually in my Kickstarter, there's a relatively new edition since last time we spoke. Uh-huh. There's a pie chart down there. And on each tier, what I do is I make sure that there is an amount of profit over and above the production and shipping costs. And also any costs that I have to do, such as Kickstarter and also sending 10% to the writers, as it says on the pie chart there. Mm-hmm. So I make sure that on every tier, there is a little bit of profit. Mm-hmm. So I know that even if for some reason all of the pledges are badly distributed into one area, which is not very profitable, I know that I can still cover everything. Mm. That's really how come, you know, I try to make the print copies of things nice and cheap.
Yeah. Did you have any remarks, or I mean, another thought that comes to mind is whether by setting the goal very low, is there concerns from people that you're devaluing the value of the work that gets involved in it, which is something that you mentioned last time as well, that people don't necessarily realize how much work goes into creating a role-playing game book, essentially.
Do I think there is a danger of that? Yes. Mm. I think that is a problem, and I don't think, unfortunately, that it's a problem I can fix right now. I can't explain to everybody, you know, how many thousands of pounds it takes to even make an expansion to a 300-page rulebook. You know, that's unfortunate. I wish I could explain it to people. I wish I could make people understand better, but I don't have the kind of reach that really does that. Actually, I had some very, very hurtful comments, on a particular platform, which won't surprise very many people. Reddit.
Yeah.
It's a very double-edged sword.
Yeah.
I always get a couple of backers, a couple of new backers from Reddit when I post my project there. Mm-hmm. But I always also get massive, massive criticism over anything that they don't agree with. Anything from, you know, my original game, which brought in $4,500 mm-hmm. in Kickstarter. You know, people were talking about, why would I play any other game than D&D? You know, I've got a D20 and that'll do me. And, you know, this looks like it's a complete waste of time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For example, on a previous project I ran, the last project I ran, in fact, Era the Empowered, which is my superheroes game.
Okay.
I got a post on my Reddit post saying, you know, Mutants and Masterminds and the Marvel game and a couple of others that I just can't bring to mind right now. Why on earth would I want another superhero game?
Which in itself is not necessarily a bad question for superhero games. It's like, what's different about this one, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, if he had asked what's different about this, but, you know, the tone of it was, I don't want another superhero game. There are four already, which are perfectly fine. I don't want any more.
Yeah, and, well, that's the nature of Reddit troll comments.
As a game creator, you know, that's a very sort of a very negative thing to have said to you, because, you know, you're trying to push the boundaries. You're trying to do something new. Mm-hmm. And for someone to go, oh, well, D&D is good enough. D&D is enough. We don't need anything else. We have no interest in anything else. It's very negative. It's very, it's a bit of a downer.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, I agree. It's a shame, definitely. But unfortunately, as you said, it's a double-edged sword, and it could get some exposure, but you get the nature of a lot of the commenters and trolls hanging around Reddit, and hanging around many different places online as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the unfortunate things about our, you know, our modern technical society and the way it works. It's sort of just something you have to learn to live with, and you have to learn to take criticism even when it's, you know, there was no constructive criticism in there. There was no, I don't like this about your game. It was just, this is a stupid idea. And you know, clearly they haven't read anything about it because, Anyway.
Anyway, it's always easier to heckle from the sidelines than actually get, like, creating anything. That's the most difficult part. And you do get exposed when you do create something, so it happens.
Yeah, you do.
So you have a very low goal that you already, like, twice over almost. Do you have a secret goal in mind for, like, what you'd ideally like to get to towards the end of this?
I do have a secret goal in mind. I'm not going to be able to tell you what it is, though.
You want to keep it secret?
It needs to be secret. I'll tell you what.
It would not.
If in one of our future conversations we exceed it, I'll tell you.
Okay, good. We can do that. That sounds like a good plan. All right. Excellent. So you've mentioned very quickly in passing a couple of your other games that you have. Do you want to talk quickly about those, or is there anything else you'd like to say about what's going on with the Kickstarter right now?
Yeah, I can talk quickly about that. There's one more risk I'd like to mention though, because I think your listeners might find it interesting.
Yeah, sure.
There's a thing about being a project creator on Kickstarter which carries with it a risk of on our end, because there's always the fear of, you know, for backers, is this person actually going to deliver what they say they're going to?
That's true.
Should we back it?
Yeah.
However, on the other end, and this has happened to me with a significant amount of money, there are a lot of people who pledge and then never actually pay.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, that's true. That's something that we don't really think about when we're backing projects.
Yeah, because the thing is, you see, Kickstarter waits until the project ends. It tries to charge your card, and then it tries every 2 days for 2 weeks to charge your card. And then if it fails to charge your card, the number on Kickstarter never shows any different.
Okay.
So, you know, for example, you might have made $4,500 on your campaign, and then $500 of that is never delivered because they don't pay.
Roughly, got it.
It is as much as 10% of pledges, in my experience, do not get paid.
And do you, as the project creator, learn about this little by little, or do you find out at the end that it just hasn't come through?
No, you only find out at the last minute because, you know, there are people who fail to pay straight away and then pay during the 2 weeks and it's no problem.
Yeah.
But I have found on average 10% of what I actually get from a Kickstarter, and that's not including the 5% that goes to Kickstarter.
Yeah, sure. So you, as a project creator, at least in games and maybe other areas, you should probably beware of finding out what the buffer zone is to make sure that you have enough to pay for the Kickstarter fees, as well as making sure that you have, like, more money than you need to be for any people not paying, basically.
Actually, it's the stretch goals which are the major worry, as for me as a project creator.
Okay.
Because, you know, if you make a stretch goal at $4,500,
yeah,
and then someone drops out, or a lot of people drop out, and you go back down to 4,000, where's that extra $500 coming from that's supposed to pay?
And you can't really drop it as long as Kickstarter still displays the full amount. You can't really tell people that you don't really have it.
You can't say, I'm sorry, and only 4,000 came in on this. Mm. You know, I don't have the money. You can't say that to your backers who've all, you know, and I'm sure some of them will have come in at the last minute trying to push to the stretch goal, you know, or they'll have increased. So, you know, you end up doing it out of pocket, to be honest. That's what I've done each time that I've only just made a stretch goal.
Wow.
You know, and it's really tricky.
Yeah. Thank you for being candid and sharing a lot of the behind the scenes of what's going on with the Kickstarter project. I hope it's going to be interesting. I know there's a lot of resources you can go and find out online, but for any future games creators or aspiring games creators, it's going to be a very interesting topic to hear about.
Yeah, and you know, if anyone has any questions or anything, then they can feel free to forward them to you or to me or whatever works.
Cool. All right, so your other games.
Yeah, my other games. So the first game I created was Era of the Consortium, which is the current Kickstarter is an expansion for it.
So by the way, before you go into the others, every one of the games starts with Era. So that's the game system?
That is the name of the rule set. But actually, the way it came about is a bit of a funny story. Originally, I was just going to call it Consortium.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a computer game that came out called Consortium just around the time I was going to Kickstarter.
Right.
And, you know, I had a quick chat with them and, you know, they were pretty set on the name because they got a long way into development and obviously I sympathized. And I didn't really want the games to get confused. You know, their kind of vision for their game, it was a sci-fi game, but it was a very different vision of sci-fi to mine.
Okay.
And you know, neither of us wanted the games to get confused. So I basically agreed to go, okay, well, I'm going to call it Era of the Consortium. And then it was only later that I decided to call the rule set the Era D10 rule set and then name my next game Era Liars, Era the Empowered.
Okay.
It's actually, it's come out really well in the end because, you know, there's a Twitter hashtag Era Games, you know, which is, it refers to all of the games that I've created.
That's cool. Yeah.
There's going to be no confusion about who's created a game if it has Era colon at the front, you know?
Yeah.
And not only that, I can't explain why, but nearly every game is set in the same universe in some way.
Okay.
So, you know, it's all the Era universe in my mind.
So in your mind, there's a thread that like links all of them, like links, you know, like those the, like those theories the that link all the Pixar movies together, similar.
Yeah. My threads are a bit less tenuous, if I'm totally honest. I think.
Sure. Okay.
But yeah.
But you're stating that it's true. Pixar never said that it was true.
So yeah, there's you know, there is this link, but I really like it because it's made my games sort of all one thing. Mm-hmm. And then, especially since, as I was talking about last time, we sort of help other people with their games as well.
Yes.
It's a very definite divider. Everyone knows what I created and what I've helped other people create. So there's no confusion when you go to the Shades of Vengeance website and look at Era of the Consortium as opposed to Order of the Link.
Yeah.
You know that this is something that I've helped someone else create. It's their vision rather than my vision.
Yeah.
Era Liars is a totally different game, like complete 180. Era Liars is a game where you are not an adventurer. You never would have made it as an adventurer. You're in a low fantasy universe, sort of like D&D, but without the magic.
Okay.
So there's magical creatures, there are magical objects, but there's no actual fireball kind of thing.
A bit like, so Game of Thrones would match that kind of description as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, Game of Thrones would be a good example. Now, in this game, you are people, as I said, who would never make it as adventurers, but you live in a city and you watch all the adventurers come in from their adventures and tell stories about the orcs that are out there and how they did this and that and the other, and they get showered with gold and glory.
Hmm.
So you go, okay, well, I'm reasonably skilled. I can look like I carry a sword and have killed some orcs. So you go out, you spend your life savings on buying a sword and a suit of armor, and then you walk into the tavern and you tell a story of your great adventure, hoping to get rewarded with golden glory.
Got it. So it's more of a storytelling.
Absolutely.
Game.
And the way that it works, it's if anyone's ever heard of Baron Munchausen,
I was just going to mention Baron Munchausen, yeah.
However, it's a team game against the GM rather than
everyone working against
each other.
All right.
So the group tell a story as a team. You know, I always give them 5 minutes to figure out what the story is going to be. And then, you know, they have to just wing it if they haven't figured anything out.
Okay.
And, it's
and so the GM plays the other people in the tavern and
all of the people in the tavern. And it's all based on opposed roles, you see.
Okay.
And as you are not adventurers, you are not very skilled. You know, you don't have oodles of skill points everywhere. You have like, 5 skills that you have and, you know, limited attributes that you're any good at.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the chances are at some point you will try to claim something that you have no idea about.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that point, you know, well, at any point where you claim something that's even vaguely, you know, questionable, for example, oh, I punched the dragon in the face so hard that it fell unconscious. The GM would then call for a strength brawl, opposed roll, between you and the best person in the audience. So, say the town blacksmith, I don't know.
Okay.
You would each roll, and whoever gets more successes wins. And if the player wins, then, you know, the blacksmith will believe them. If the blacksmith wins, then, you know, he'll start to disbelieve, or he may even start to heckle, or he may just walk out, you know, and say that this story is ridiculous. It's clearly not true. And this opposed role is supposed to sort of symbolize going and having an arm wrestle or something without breaking the flow of the story.
Okay. And it sounds like a lot of fun, and I really like the idea. It doesn't sound like something that you'd play several games of or a campaign of, does it?
You wouldn't really, you can play a campaign of it. I mean, there is sort of an ultimate goal of gaining enough money to buy a house and live the rest of your life comfortably.
So by the end of the story, you would hope beyond a free meal that some of the people would, well, give you money for the story.
Yeah. And there are all kinds of rules about how engaged people are and how much money they give you as a result.
Okay.
But totally honestly, no. I mean, you're not going to sit there and play 10 sessions in a row of this game. This game is fantastic for, oh, you know what? We have a session scheduled and only 4 of the normal 8 can make it.
Yeah.
Which is what I had last weekend, actually. We sat down and played a game of Liars.
Right.
It's really good fun. It's great for a quick one shot. Even a short campaign of maybe 3 sessions.
Got it. And that, so you, the game is for sale on your main website?
On my main website. It's actually even an add-on on the Kickstarter.
Okay.
What so level? If you want Era of the Consortium and you also want Era Liars, then you can get it under add-ons. No, other Shades of Vengeance games. I'm sorry. It's £10 for the digital version, £20 for the paperback version, and £28 for the hardcover.
By the way, you have a lot of different pledge levels because I'm just scrolling down as you're saying this and I'm looking at it. Is that based on experience because people wanted a lot of different things or?
Yeah, that is it exactly. The problem is, and I have a pledge matrix that shows you exactly what you get. The problem is combinations. Because what I did try once was to have just a very few levels, mm-hmm. and then say, okay, anything else you want, you can just add some money in as an add-on, and we'll get it to you. But no one actually added add-ons. Mm-hmm. You know, very very few people actually did it, because it's sort of more difficult.
Yeah.
So what I've started doing is this pledge matrix that you'll find very near the top of the project.
Yeah, I see it.
Which explains exactly what you get, so you can check for the rewards you want, and then find the level that gives you those rewards.
Yeah, that seems to be working better. Yeah, because it's, that way people don't have to think about it. They just choose the option they need, and they don't have to. They feel they don't have to think about it further.
Well, they don't have to add numbers together and make sure it's right and so on. I mean, all of my maths is fine, but They don't have to worry about, okay, so I wanted that 40 quid tier, but then I want the add-on for £13, and then the add-on for £6, and then the add-on for £3.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Blah, 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 blah. Right?
Yeah.
So you don't have to worry about it because it's there.
Yeah. Got it. Cool.
So yeah, and then the other game that I created that I've mentioned briefly already was Era the Empowered.
Yes.
That is it's a take on superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
How to explain it briefly. Instead of playing a single superhero throughout a long, long game, the idea is that you play a dynasty of superheroes.
Okay.
Each more powerful than the last. So you play as the first individual who faces certain challenges, and then things escalate. You know, this individual retires or whatever, and then the next person takes over.
So you in play a dynasty of characters and like maybe one game, you change character after every session?
No, it wouldn't be as frequent as that. It might be every 5 sessions you change characters, for example.
Okay.
You wouldn't want to change characters every session, really, because then no character really had a day out, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Is it a contemporary, like here and now kind of setting?
No, actually it's set in the 1990s. Like early 90s, 1993 onwards.
Okay.
the reason is that I grew up on the animated Spider-Man and various others, mm-hmm. As I'm sure a lot of people my age did. I really loved those, and I really thought that for me, they made the essence of what the superhero was.
Right.
I view everything that I see now through that lens. So for me, you know, that was the definitive time that I began to understand what superheroes really were and what they meant. Beyond, you know, the sort of Superman trope of everything's so easy, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I decided to go ahead with that. I went ahead with that for the artwork, for the logo. You know, I kind of followed through on that idea. And, you know, in those series as well, there was a lot of sort of alternate universe hopping and travel forward in time stuff, things like that. And I've tried to include those kinds of elements. So rather than being based so much on the comics, it's more based on the TV series, both the Marvel and the DC ones. More the Marvel art style. I think that was, that lends itself better to a role-playing game and still images. But I was always very impressed with the DC writing standard,
mm-hmm.
So I kind of included some elements from that.
Great, thank you. Well, that's all very interesting. I think wrap up here for now, and then we can talk about next time where you're at with the Kickstarter project, as well as some of the other games that you help other creators develop. I'll be interested in that side of what you're doing as well.
Sure.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Okay, so that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed the conversation I had with Ed. There's more to come. Next week, there's going to be the second part of the conversation with Ed. A lot more to talk about with the updates to the Kickstarter project, what else has been happening. You can go and check out his Kickstarter project. I really encourage you to go and check it out and support independent role-playing game design and publishing, of course. If you've enjoyed anything to do with the conversation and would like to discover a new science fiction universe, the science fiction universe of Eero the Consortium that Ed has created. And what else to say? That's it, really. Just send it to a friend. Really appreciate your time. I appreciate your consideration. Appreciate you listening to this particular podcast till the end. You can find more of it and everything else to do with all the Ice Cream for Everyone content on the website. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Look out for the next episode of this podcast coming out in about a week or so. All right. Cheers. Bye.